Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama went to Moscow today. He did a lot of talking about resetting relations with Russia. Getting back to business as usual might be another way to put that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you with us on this Monday. It is the 6th of July today. The big news out of President Obama's visit to Russia today was about nuclear weapons. He and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev agreed to cut nuclear arsenals by a third, and there was a big formal signing ceremony at the Kremlin. But there is more to this summit than meets the eye. The list of people traveling with the president could have been drawn straight from the pages of the Fortune 500. Executives from Boeing and John Deere and Pepsi are just some of those along for the ride, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
It's been almost 18 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and still, Russia only accounts for about 1% of U.S. trade. Angela Stent is director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University.
People always thought after the collapse of communism, there would be a major breakthrough, that there would be huge opportunities for U.S. business there, and it hasn't quite worked out like that.
Stent says even today, U.S. investors are wary.
Because there really is no rule of law in Russia, U.S. companies have questions about how safe their investments are and whether the agreements they make with Russian companies will be honored.
Just look at IKEA. The Swedish retailer said last month that it's canceling all further investment in Russia, citing corruption and demand for bribes. But today, there's news that Boeing will announce a partnership with a Russian titanium maker, and Pepsi is boosting investment by a third. Jeff Barnett is with the U.S.-Russia Business Council. He says trade ties could flourish if political ties actually warm up.
A lot of companies realize this is a risky market, but it's also a market in which they can realize higher returns.
Barnett sees the U.S. commercial relationship with China as the model. The economic ties are so strong, they've been able to overshadow political squabbles time and again. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Robert Gerber is clearly a guy who doesn't like to waste time. For those of you not familiar with the roster of federal judges, Gerber is running General Motors' trip through bankruptcy court. Usually takes more than a year for companies to make their way to the other side of Chapter 11. But the way GM is moving, it could be out in months. And Judge Gerber really put the pedal to the metal last night. He ruled that GM can indeed sell off the best parts of its business to a new GM. It'll be owned by the U.S. and Canadian governments and a union healthcare fund. It will have all the best brands GM's got left, but will it still have a place in America's hearts? Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
American cars used to be practically synonymous with an American identity, but America isn't what it used to be, and neither are its cars. Michael Robinette follows the global market for auto consultant CSM Worldwide. He says the new GM can't bank too much on its gloried past.
Chevrolet, as we may have known it back in the 50s or 60s, will have to stay there.
Instead, he says, the company needs to move past its history to create something new that people actually want to buy. That'll most likely mean smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. It'll definitely mean fewer of them. Alan Baum is an auto consultant in Michigan. He says to see the future, take a look across the Atlantic.
If you look at the European market, you see a market that is essentially very competitive with a lot of players, none of which have dominant shares.
GM sells well in China, so it's already realized that it has to compete globally and not just in the U.S. Baum says now it has to figure out what companies like Toyota have been doing for a long time, build a kind of transnational vehicle at a reasonable price. John Quelch studies marketing at Harvard. He says GM can't rely on waving the American flag to sell cars anymore.
There are relatively fewer and fewer consumers who are willing to pay a premium or suffer a deficit in product quality in order to be patriotic and buy American.
Quelch says GM has to build a new car for America, not the new American car. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
This next item might be the financial industry's equivalent of stealing the secret formula for Coca-Cola, or maybe the Colonel's famous recipe of 11 herbs and spices. At the very least, it's a great case of corporate espionage. Stock trading, a lot of it done by computers, is often measured in microseconds. So the big Wall Street firms each rely on their own specially crafted computer programs to give them an edge. Goldman Sachs, for one example, has made hundreds of millions of dollars on what's known as program trading. But our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports there is word today that Goldman's secret formula may have been compromised.
The FBI accuses Russian-born Sergei Alenikov of taking more than just what he knew about his former employer's trading practices. He's charged with copying secret mathematical computer formulas used to make highly profitable trades. Andrew Lowe is a computer trading expert at MIT. He says there's an ongoing arms race of sorts in the financial world.
If you have a better computer system than your competitors to be able to process all of your clients' orders in a much more timely and price-effective manner, you'll actually be able to save your clients money.
And, of course, make huge amounts of money in the process. Lowe says that's why the financial giants invest so much in these secret formulas.
Oh, it's hundreds of man years of effort. They hire armies of PhDs in economics, finance, mathematics, computer science, physics. And, of course, it is an arms race in the sense that when they develop a slight advantage, then other firms are going to try to figure what those are and implement the next generation.
Goldman Sachs isn't even confirming that it is the generically named financial institution listed in the FBI complaint, but New York Stock Exchange figures suggest Goldman may have suspended much of its program trading recently. At the University of California at Berkeley, financial innovation expert David Lineweber says that might be an overreaction.
I think they may be erring on the side of panic. This is one of those things where if you knew the formula for going to the moon, could you get to the moon?
Lineweber says there are only a few firms really big enough to benefit from such a leak. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Whatever program trading there was on Wall Street today didn't wind up making much of a difference in the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you managed to keep an eye on the business and economics pages over the long weekend, perhaps you noticed the rising tide of stimulus news. New stimulus news, that is. There has been a steady stream of commentary and punditry calling for another shot of government spending, even though most of the nearly $800 billion that Congress and President Obama approved in February still has not been spent. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
If you talk to James Galbraith these days, he's feeling vindicated. Back in January, Galbraith was arguing the administration's proposal for a nearly $1 trillion economic stimulus package was too small. And now, Galbraith, a liberal-leaning economist at the University of Texas, says rising unemployment and a stubbornly stagnant economy are proving him right. Still,
I'm not going to gloat too much, though, because there were political considerations.
He believes President Obama pushed for the biggest stimulus package that was politically possible, but
difficulty here is that it's not quite big enough, not quite soon enough.
Even shovel-ready projects take months to get started. And Dean Baker at the Center for Economic Policy Research says infrastructure projects are not enough. He'd like Congress to offer direct aid to state and local governments.
So they don't have to make the cutbacks that so many state and local governments are making now. That's going to make the recession much worse.
But these economic concerns are running headlong into an unpleasant political reality on Capitol Hill.
At the moment, there is no appetite for another stimulus package.
Norm Ornstein follows Congress at the American Enterprise Institute.
you've got an awful lot of fiscally conservative Democrats who have grown increasingly uneasy about the hole we have dug.
Senior Democratic aides in the House say for the moment there are no plans for a new stimulus bill. Instead, they're focusing on getting money from the last bill out the door faster. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
For those who are keeping track, by the by, a new stimulus package, if there is one, would be the third of this recession, not the second. Remember, Congress and the Bush administration passed the first one back in the spring of 2008. Bad as the economy is, there are a lot of businesses out there doing pretty well, despite or maybe because of the recession. Today, we're going to kick off a series we're calling The Upside, where we profile some of those businesses that are doing better than most. Garden centers are a good one. Penny pinchers are planting their own fruits and veggies to cut down on grocery bills, and they do have to get those seeds and starter plants someplace.
Grapes, berries, vegetables, herbs.
My name is Tom Gibbon, and I own the Marina Del Rey Garden Center.
We've seen a lot of growth in vegetables, herbs, edibles would be citrus, fruit trees, anything of that nature. We're an independent garden center. We're not a chain. And we've developed a relationship with our customers, and they know that they can trust what we're going to tell them and suggestions we'll make to them. And by building that trust with the consumer, they come back and they help us be successful. The families are bringing their children in, and they're picking out the seeds and the vegetables and, you know, stuff like corn. And the kids are really getting excited about it because I don't think they had any concept of where their food came from. It does not come from the supermarket. And if families turn a little section of their garden into growing food, I think they'll understand better where food comes from. Gardeners are very passionate people, and regardless of what the economy is doing, they will continue to garden. They'll find ways to cut back, but they're not going to eliminate gardening.
That was Tom Gibbon at the Marina Del Rey Garden Center, not far from downtown Los Angeles. American consumers appreciate nothing so much as a good bargain, paying less than full price. What often happens, of course, is that being cheap winds up costing us more money in the end. And that's what happened to author Ellen Ruppel Schell, and it led to her latest book, Cheap, The High Price of Discount Culture.
I had a great outfit that I bought, of course, on super sale. I was so proud of myself. And then I went to find a pair of boots and found, you know, mostly clunky, not very nice-looking boots. And I asked the proprietor, gee, can you bring me, you know, some more stuff? And he brought me out this luscious pair of Italian boots, and I instantly fell in love until I saw their price tag. And I said, oh, God, you know, really can't justify this purchase. So I bought a pair of the clunky boots that were a lot cheaper. They didn't really fit me too well. I wore them the next night, wasn't very happy with them, threw them to the back of my closet, never wore them again. So the question is, really, how much did I save by buying those cheaper boots, wearing them once, and not wearing them again?
Absent the rest of us having a bad boot experience, as you did, though,
how do we
collectively change that mindset of, oh man, I'm getting a deal?
We celebrate bargains, and we are being trained to look first at price and second at the object we're considering. So when you go in, I suggest to consumers, to shoppers, and to myself, I now look at these different items, whatever it may be, it's whether it's a pair of socks or a sweater or a wrench, and I think first, do I want this? Is this going to work for me? Is it going to really fill my need? And if so, then I look at the price. If I can afford it, I go forward. If I can't afford it, I move on. Doesn't mean I don't look at the sale racks. I certainly do. But I am no longer, and I encourage people to be no longer driven, first and foremost, by price.
This actually is part of a different kind of discussion. The fact that American consumers really have no idea
of how prices are set. I mean, we walk in and we see a price and we're like, okay, that's the price. But really, we don't understand the dynamics behind that at all.
You know, it's absolutely fascinating, and I didn't either until I researched this. How many of us, for example, have ever paid full price for a mattress? There's an object that is, you know, it's always quote-unquote on sale. Well, it's not really on sale. That's the real price of the mattress. The other mattresses in that department store have higher prices, but the merchant doesn't really expect to sell those mattresses. He rotates all his mattresses into the sale pile, and he expects to sell them at that sale price, which is actually the full price. There are legions of PhDs who help large chain stores in particular set both the price and the markdown price. And they're exquisitely sensitive to changes in consumer behavior. They can change prices daily. These markdowns are set according to consumer behavior to maximize the chance that these items will be bought. And what once was an art is now a very, very sophisticated science.
Ellen Ruppel Schell teaches at Boston University. She writes for The Atlantic Magazine, and she's written a book, too. It's called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Ellen, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, hugs for a good cause.
So while every other cause typically sees some kind of a decline during recession, religious groups are usually insulated from it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets were of two minds today. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.5%, 44 points, closed at 8,324. The NASDAQ, though, lost 0.5%. That is 9 points, finished at 1787. The S&P 500 ticked up 0.25%, 2 points, ended the day at 898. Financial stocks were a mixed bag, too. Bank of America unloaded more than 3.75%. Citigroup was off just over 3%, but JPMorgan Chase added on 1%, and American Express charged up more than 5.5%. Fears that the recovery is still far off hit commodities hard. Oil fell to $64 a barrel. That sent energy shares down. Chevron and Exxon lost nearly 0.5% each. Mining giant Freeport-McMoRan sheared off more than 7.5% today. Consumer goods companies served up some good news. Cereal giant Kellogg's poured on more than 2%. Kraft Foods cooked up a gain of 1.8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.51%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
And now doctors. Details at AngiesList.com. And by ConAgra Foods, the people behind brands like Banquet, Hebrew National, and Peter Pan. More at ConAgraFoods.com. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. President Obama continues talks with leaders in Moscow. He'll meet with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. In Washington, Minnesotan Al Franken is scheduled to be sworn into the Senate. And in Los Angeles, thousands of fans are expected downtown for a tribute to the King of Pop, Michael Jackson. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tennis fans who happened to be up early were treated to a fabulous men's final at Wimbledon yesterday morning. Roger Federer beat Andy Roddick in a five-set classic. You might even call it a clutch performance. Even though Federer was the top seed, he still needed a long five sets to win his 15th and record Grand Slam title. We use sports analogies like clutch performance all the time in everyday life. But behavioral economist Dan Ariely says sports really can teach us something about life outside arenas and ballparks.
Here's a question for you.
All right.
Do you know the term clutch players?
Yeah, sure, you bet. People who make a shot or make a play or whatever under immense pressure.
You know, lots of people believe in clutch players. People believe that there's these magical individuals who do better under stress. But the question is, do they really exist? So what do you think? So,
well, I don't know, but right about here, I'm going to guess you're going to tell me about a study you did, right? Because that's the way these conversations usually go.
That's right. So first of all, we asked people if they believe that they're clutch players, and people believe that they're clutch players. People also agree on who the clutch players are in the NBA. So everything seems fine. And when we look at how many points these people who are called clutch players score in the last 5 minutes of the game compared to a randomly chosen 5 minutes of the game, they actually score better.
So then the money that they get is money well spent by the team, yes?
Well, that's not clear yet, because remember that even if they get more points, there are two ways to get more points. One is to increase your percentage scoring, and the other one is just to try more. So we looked at their performance, not in terms of absolute scores, but in terms of percentages. Mm-hmm. And what do you think happened now?
I don't know. That's actually a good point. So LeBron James and Kobe Bryant and those guys, are they actually better percentage-wise when the pressure's on? I don't actually know. That's a good question.
And the answer is no. The answer is no. Their percentage keep the same. I mean, they're all good players, by the way. They're the best players there are, but they don't seem to have any clutchness. And this goes both for field goal and for three throws.
So it really seems like it's a perception thing, right? These guys are perceived to be better in the clutch, so we shovel the ball at them more and hence more money, and then they actually do wind up scoring more points, but percentage-wise, it's a wash.
And you can think about it as a group coordination mechanism where these guys believe that they're better, the coach believes that they're better, the team believes that they're better, so they get the ball more frequently, and they try more, they just don't succeed more, but there's kind of an arrangement that says that they will succeed more.
Bring this back to the corporate world for me for a second. Yeah. Let's say you've got a hotshot lawyer in a law firm or some mergers and acquisitions specialist in a takeover company. Are they going to get the higher salary because they are perceived to be better at closing the deal or winning the conviction and then get more money for that?
Yes, I think that there could be the same thing happening in the business world where we bring people in that we think that they are particularly good at performing under stress, that they are particularly good at the closing moment, the important points. And even if there's no evidence for it, the fact that we all agree on it could actually give these people more chances and they could score more points business-wise, even if their performance doesn't truly increase.
At some point, though, Dan, don't even clutch players hit a cold streak, whether it's in the business world or on the court or on the playing field, and then their clutchness factor kind of goes away?
It could happen, but here comes another human element, which is our faulty memory. And you can think to yourself about what do you remember from different basketball game. So from Michael Jordan, for example, there's a very famous shot that he made to win the championship, and people remember this shot very, very strongly. Very few people remember that the game before that, where they could have won the series, he missed the final shot. So there's not just the question of how good in clutchness are these players, but how faulty is our memory, and do we just remember the good ending?
Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
You know how sometimes you just need a hug? Should you find yourself in New York City tomorrow with a couple of hours to spare, I think something can probably be arranged. For the past 22 years, an Indian spiritual leader named Amma has been touring the country preaching love and compassion and the healing power of a good hug. New York is the eighth stop on her current tour. More than 8,000 people are expected to line up for a moment or two in her arms and perhaps pick up some Amma souvenirs while they're at it. April Demboski spent some time at one of Amma's earlier stops.
Going to an Amma hug-in is like entering a new age theme park. There's constant music, groupies of all ages wearing saris and hemp clothing, and endless talk of love and peace. But rather than yoga or psychedelics, the spiritual high comes from the hugs.
Every time I get a hug, I just start crying hysterically.
Lizzie Corley is 14. Her parents have been bringing her to see Amma since she was two. At 55 years old, Amma has hugged more than 28 million people since she gave her first hug in her native India as a young girl. People regularly wait 10 hours to spend 10 seconds in her arms. They say her hugs promote enlightenment, calm anxieties, and even cure illness. While they wait, there is plenty visitors can do to keep themselves occupied. There's group meditation, live music, and English translations of her teachings on the sound system.
If the wife and husband live in mutual understanding, the increasing sense of alienation between them will decrease.
And of course, there's shopping. Amma's official boutique travels everywhere she does. It sells books, CDs, essential oils, sweatshirts, and mugs stamped with the Amma logo. There are bracelets blessed by Amma, necklaces worn by Amma. For the kids, the stuffed Amma doll comes in three sizes, a small for $45, the large with legs for $185. Betsy Barnett works the cash register at the boutique. She explains that all of Amma's staff are volunteers. They pay for their own travel, food, and lodging during the tour. Some even donate extra cash in addition to their time.
So say someone donates $10, it's really like $100 because there's no overhead, there's no administrative costs, there's no health insurance being paid.
But apparently, all that money isn't lining the folds of Amma's sari. Signs at the boutique claim 100% of net revenues go to her humanitarian projects in India. Her website says she sponsors orphanages, schools, hospitals for the poor, soup kitchens, disaster relief programs. But Amma's volunteers refuse to discuss how much money she makes.
I just don't think that's appropriate.
Christian Battaglia was selling lemon bars at the Amma snack shack.
I actually don't take care of any of the money issues at the end of the day.
All of her organizations are registered as nonprofit religious groups, so they're not required to file tax returns. But the San Jose Mercury News puts her total worth in the hundreds of millions. Traveling the world giving free hugs seems to be a recession-proof fundraising strategy. Stacey Palmer is the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy.
People feel very strong affiliation to their religion and to their obligations to give. So while every other cause typically sees some kind of a decline during recession, religious groups are usually insulated from it.
And if followers run out of sandalwood incense, they can log on to Amma.org and buy more. Vijay Menon volunteers every Friday at Amma's U.S. headquarters in San Ramon, California. He packs and ships orders to devotees in the U.S., Europe, Asia, even Antarctica.
Well, then I think people want to feel a sense of closeness, you know, and so when Amma's not here, they like to buy products.
So when the chanting drifts away and the smell of rose petals fades from the air, people will still have their Amma shampoo and tote bags to hold near their heart.
Oh, bye, Amma. We love you.
In San Ramon, California, I'm April Domboski for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, an observation about the post-Pentagon career of Robert McNamara. The former Secretary of Defense died early this morning at the age of 93, and he will be remembered rightly for his role in the conduct of the war in Vietnam and his later very public change of heart about it. Less talked about, though, is that after he left the Pentagon, McNamara spent a dozen years running and expanding the World Bank. Its role in development economics today, good and or bad, is largely the one that McNamara built. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow pumped up 44 points, a half percent. The Nasdaq dropped 9 points. That is also a half percent. The S&P 500 rose 2 points, a quarter of 1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the broadcast, checking in with one of the kings of search.
From our perspective, the appetite for being online, to knowing what other people are doing, to communicate, to share ideas, to be entertained, to figure out what Britney Spears is doing, you know, this demand is insatiable.
Maybe not that Britney Spears part. It's a conversation from the corner office, this time with Google CEO Eric Schmidt. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.